Doctor, I'm a KED salesman, and I've got a problem.
You sure have. Well, stop thinking like a sneaker salesman and start thinking like a casual shoe salesman. You're gonna have it better than you've ever had it before. Just take this attitude when you walk into a store.
Our casual shoes, the best a foot can put on a floor. You're gonna have it better than you've ever had it before.
As a writer on Late Night with David Letterman, Steve Young's duties included scouring through record bins in search of potential subjects for the show's Dave's Record Collection segments. Little did he know his hunt for offbeat vinyl would thrust him into this world of Broadway-style industrial musicals, put on by such companies as GE, McDonald's, Ford, and Xerox, all at their annual sales meetings in the 1950s through the 1980s. These productions dazzled and motivated their only intended audience, each company's sales force, which was regaled with lavish productions such as Lipton on the Move, Lucite U and 72, The Bathrooms Are Coming, and this little ditty from GE's Go Fly a Kite, Be Direct With Me.
Two straight parallel wires bearing current in the same direction attract each other, if you know what I mean.
The documentary Bathtubs Over Broadway follows Young's odyssey as he tracks down these shows' souvenir albums. He finds kindred fanatics, interviews the performers, songwriters, and directors, and discovers rare performance footage of songs such as My Bathroom and Everything's Coming Up Sitco. Bathtubs Over Broadway is now streaming on Netflix, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Steve Young to the roundtable this morning. Steve, how are you?
Oh, hi, Joe. Thank you so much. I've got to compliment you. That was one of the most concise and sparkling summaries of a very arcane topic that I've ever heard. I've spent the last 20-something years trying to explain to baffled people what I've been collecting and what I've been doing, and you just nailed it.
Well, let me just ask you about the origin story here, because as I indicated, you're going through records at used record stores to find funny things for Dave's record collection.
Here we go!
Dave's record collection!
Here we have an album. It's called Number One Hard. Now, this is a musical. Please don't make up your own jokes. Number One Hard, it's a musical about the Canadian grain industry, and we'll be hearing a song from this album entitled Wheat.
And I remember as a viewer seeing these songs come up every once in a while and just thinking, well, out of context, this is hilarious. What I did not necessarily realize, as you illustrate here, that even in context, they're hilarious.
Well, it is quite a labyrinth of meaning and intended audience and context and out of context and all that. The segment started before I even joined the show. Dave Letterman and some of his original writers kind of at one point said, you know, I've got a weird record album. Hey, I do too. Hey, this could be a found item comedy piece on the show. And that's how it began. And it kind of hit this golden age stretch of the celebrities who shouldn't have been singing, who for a while, that was a trend for like people like William Shatner to put out a record album, or Anthony Quinn or somebody, and they got a lot of good mileage out of that. And by the time I joined the staff, a lot of that had been found, and it was more like dictation practice, and listen to these business letters and learn to take dictation, or hear how to touch type, or teach your parakeet to talk, which is a pretty good gold mine for out-of-context weird clips also. But I started finding these corporate souvenir albums. By the time I had three or four of them, I thought, is this an actual genre? This seems insane that this top-level production value musicals about the inner workings of a company and why its sales force should be excited and why everyone should have an extra spring in their step when they go to work on Monday. I just thought, I understand that I'm not the intended audience, but I love it all the more for that. I want to pull back the curtain on this world, and I was off and running.
My insurance man, the man we rely on. My insurance man, the best of them all, who serves all coverage needs. That's why he succeeds. My insurance man, is that what they...
It's amazing. It's actually more annoying than my insurance man.
You come to this, and this is one of the things that I found fascinating about the documentary, is that it is not only the story of these industrial musicals, but we also learn about you and your quest in the process. You use a term several times during the film, and it is introduced early, and I'm hoping you can describe it because I do think it sets the tone, which is you refer to your state as comedy damage.
Yeah, I'll just mention that the director and creator of this film, Deva Hwisanant, when she started working on this, she did not realize the scope of the story that would ultimately power this movie. And it did turn out to be more about me than perhaps I would have guessed or anyone else. But comedy damage, I would describe it as when you've spent too much time writing jokes, thinking about jokes, analyzing comedy, it just becomes not surprising anymore. It's very hard to get a laugh from me with written and produced comedy because I've got a million schematic diagrams in my mind that I can scan instantly and say, yes, that checks out. It's good. It's solidly constructed. I admire that joke. I'm not going to laugh at it because it doesn't surprise me on some level, but I admire it. So when you have that settled into your bones and you think, what can surprise me on a creative and comedic level now? I had to go pretty far afield, and I settled on this world I could not have imagined the scope of, which was these musicals that were done earnestly. They had comedy in them. They were full of inside jokes for the sales force and the company insiders. They straddled this world of, this doesn't seem like it should exist, and if it does exist, it shouldn't be this good, and if it is this good, there shouldn't be so much of it, and if it's so much that's so good, it shouldn't be unknown. And so I just felt like I have fallen down into a different universe here.
Battery clocks, yes, we've got battery clocks that nobody's got. Our battery clocks are hotter than hot.
Come on now, everybody sing it.
Battery clocks, yes, we've got battery clocks that nobody's got. Our battery clocks are hotter than hot.
And yet, as you go through and find a new album and a new show that you weren't aware of, that schematic still isn't in your head.
I find, especially with music now, music can provide the joy and surprise that comedy provides more easily for other people. And so the conceptual nature of this stuff plus the music vaults me into some level where any new record I find might be this golden experience.
And a golden experience in the joy of the find, but also of the material of which is on that album or in that tape.
Right. I mean, I do have the sort of collector vibe of, okay, I have this, but I don't have that, so I need to find that. And when I find it, I'll be happy because I can cross it off the list and put it in the cabinet. But the real joy is when something that you didn't even know exists turns up, and maybe it's from a fellow collector that you've befriended, and you have this whole social human layer to the adventure where you're meeting people and cultivating these contacts and relationships, and something new crosses your path that is so bizarrely whimsical yet right for its original purpose and so off the charts crazy for out of context decades later. Once in a while, there's still that hit of, oh my God, I can't believe this lawnmower show exists and it's so good, I'm going to be singing this for the rest of my life.
What is fascinating about this genre is that, okay, what's fascinating is that it existed.
Mm-hmm.
And then that these shows would be done, and I kept on thinking of this as I was watching the documentary. You think of what a normal Broadway show goes through. These were high-level productions with usually high-level people involved, as you point out, and they would be performed once, twice. That's it.
That is another crazy element of this, the ephemeral nature of these things. Millions of dollars, literally millions of dollars spent to put together a musical for, let's say, the Pepsi-Cola Bottlers Convention. And it's a knockout, and it's full of A-list talent, and the songs are fabulous. And then it's over. It might have just been performed once. Maybe some of the car shows went to five different cities because there's a lot of Chevy dealers in the country. But in most cases, there was not any sort of recording made of these things. The hundreds of records I have in my collection are the very much the exception. Almost nothing was saved in any tangible form. You see me in the movie going through a composer's archives in his basement in these rotting cardboard boxes, spilling out with thousands of pages of material of shows that I'm sure were beautiful and powerful, and just they don't exist except in these yellowing manuscript pages now.
You make a couple of points also about the creators of these shows, which in many cases you are lucky enough to meet before they pass. And these are some of the giants of the industry, or people that you say, you have a quote in the documentary of wondering what would happen if the lyrics just were different and they were singing songs, that those writers could be legendary.
Yeah, I've found wonderful satisfaction in getting an education about Broadway sort of backwards and upside down, because many of the people who did this stuff were young strivers who would become famous later, like Cheetah Rivera, Florence Henderson, Martin Short, writers like John Kander and Fred Ebb, Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock. You see me interview Sheldon Harnick in the documentary. But the emotional heart of it, I think, is Deva realizing there are a lot of people who did this work, and it was fantastic work, and they had made this bargain where they got good money for doing this, and they knew, in all probability, no one outside, maybe not even their family, would ever truly understand the power of the work they had done for this very limited project. And then decades later, I show up at their doorstep and say, guess what? Your work has been noticed, and we're going to talk about it, and what you had given up on the world ever understanding, now the world's going to talk about it.
The Holy Grail in the documentary becomes the bathrooms are coming.
My bathroom is a private kind of place, very special kind of place, the only place where I can stay, making faces at my face.
That is a blue chip item that is hard to avoid at any level, visually, conceptually, just the album cover. The songs are great, the performances are great, and now there's this galaxy of very deep personal connections that I have with the people involved with that 50-year-old show.
Which was performed?
Two stage performances in January of 1969, Las Vegas and Atlanta. And then American Standard said, you know what we've got to do? We've got to get the plumbing fixture distributor community more fired up about this. We're going to make a souvenir album, and we're going to make a film. And, that's a small spoiler for the movie that there is a film. But, boy, once you see the vintage footage of this American Standard bathroom fixture musical, you're just going to think, all right, this is what Steve Young, the comedy damaged guy, was looking for. This is what finally rang the bell of the ultimate form of, I can't believe it. I cannot believe it, and yet it is real.
And you could correct me on this, but there's a moment where you show the album cover, and you're like, "All right, what's the caveman? What's that about?" Oh, you're trying in your mind to figure out how that could even fit into an industrial musical bathrooms.
That was a wonderful thing for a long time. This album cover of The Bathrooms Are Coming, filled with these little snapshots of something here and there going on in the show, you don't know what it is, and you can rarely figure out from the songs. So I had kind of given up on ever understanding It was just this half-broken Rosetta Stone where chunks of history seemed to be lost, and yet suddenly they weren't.
On your drywall, a utility shelf, its use as good as gold. For books and kits, martinis too, a safety bar to hold. For cigarettes, a storage shelf with lots of room to spare. For soap, shampoo, and bubble bath, and your rubber teddy bear, you're gonna win with Shower Tower. It's in two-headed shower, you'll win with Shower Tower.
Steve Young's story is told in the documentary Bathtubs Over Broadway, which is now streaming on Netflix.
In Washington, he come back from Ice Cold Valley Forge. All the people, they say, you done a fine job, George. He got cheers and applause from the mob. They gave him the presidential job. But was Georgie happy? No, he sob. Why? Because everybody, he got no Westinghouse franchise. He got no Westinghouse franchise. Him won the war, but him got no star. And that's why the tears, they dim his eyes.
I am also interested in the fact that once you track down the album and then you open up the circle of people and then all of a sudden you see somebody's name in a Facebook profile and then you start putting pieces together and you are able to track down some of the people who actually performed in this, the people who aren't the Cheetah Riveras and the Florence Hendersons. But even the Cheetahs and Florences and these unknowns are all very proud of that work.
Especially the well-known names. They ended up with their level of success no longer worrying that the association with industrials would tar them somehow as second-rate people. There was always a whiff of a possible stigma. If you did a lot of industrials, you might not be taken seriously as a real contender for Broadway or legitimate theater. You might be sort of written off as, well, he's very glib, or, well, you know, she's very good, but she's an industrial-type performer. The people like Florence Henderson and Cheetah Rivera who came up through that and then kept going to true stardom, they look back on this very proudly, which was striking. They just said, like Florence Henderson told me, those Oldsmobile dealer shows I did, I would put them up against anything on Broadway. They were so chock full of A-list talent and verve and joy and panache. And Cheetah Rivera also said this was such a fantastic training ground. You got paid very, very well to do these shows. And you worked with other people who were on their way up, and you built your chops, and you learned the ropes, and you did it. You got out there, like Martin Short was saying, you were thrown into this stuff as a young performer, and you learned to do it. You had to do it all, and you had to do it well. And you got paid better than you'd ever gotten paid in your life. So the people whose names you recognize look back on this with absolute pride and fondness.
There's points where, oh, look, it's Tony Randall. Yeah. Or, oh, look, it's Dom DeLuise.
Yeah.
Those are wonderful moments. And you really do wish, oh, I want to see this entire thing now. The other aspect is the longevity, really. We're talking 50s through the 80s. That is a long time.
One other aspect of this movie, Deva has done so many resonant threads putting this thing together. It's an examination of 20th century culture in a way that we've never quite seen before through the eyes of what was the business world like in the golden post-war period where just everything was humming. And then you hit the 70s and malaise and uncertainty. And then we're past that into the trying to figure out our postmodern America and all that. It really does ask a lot of questions about how do companies and organizations relate to their employees, motivate their teams? How do people get up every day and try to be excited about what they're working on? Does that come just from inside you, or does that come from an inspiring organization? What kind of changes have happened in society and the business world that have made it not 1957 anymore? And is there any hope for rebuilding the better parts of that? So for a documentary that starts out about a very kitschy topic with a comedy writer, it gets into some very powerful topics, I think, and it doesn't necessarily say that we have all the answers, but we are asking questions maybe differently.
One of the questions that you look to ask and answer, which I think is fascinating, is that you're coming to the end of your career with The Letterman Show. You're then thinking, what was it like for these creative forces to just stop doing what they had done for most of their life? And for you, as still a relatively young man, of having a, 30-year career behind you of, well, now what?
David Letterman, host of The Late Show on CBS, says he is retiring next year.
Paul and I will be wrapping things up and taking a hike. Thank you. Thanks to everybody.
That was a surprise in the early stages of shooting the documentary. We didn't know at first that Dave was going to announce his retirement from The Late Show. And when that happened, I think Dava was taken aback and not sure how this would affect the nascent story that she thought she was going to tell. But ultimately, it turned out to be a very powerful parallel. We see the rise and fall of this hidden subculture of show business, and then we see suddenly Dave Letterman on TV announcing his retirement, and I've been there for 25 years, and it's not quite the only job I've ever known, but close. And now I've got gray hair, and I'm trying to figure out what do I do for the next chapter. So it did parallel very interestingly the experience for a lot of performers and writers who said, yeah, just as the 80s went on, it kind of softened, and then it just kind of stopped, and we were all kind of left in the lurch. It never ended completely. You see some glimpses of more modern iterations of these corporate shows, but there was a golden age that stopped.
Rest easy, there is a Walmart the Musical.
Yes, and it's very good. And when you see in the movie the production number with the dancers and the shopping carts, it'll kind of make you go, oh, this is legit.
So one of the other things is that the musicals themselves all seem to come out of that great golden musical format. They weren't necessarily, correct me if I'm wrong, I didn't at least see it in the documentary, where there was perhaps a Andrew Lloyd Webber phase of the industrial musical.
There was a history that sort of tracked with the rise and fall of musicals as mainstream middle-class entertainment in America. In the 50s, when this stuff was really getting going on the corporate side, it was understood that musicals like My Fair Lady or South Pacific, that was solid, widespread middle-class entertainment. Millions and millions of people had the soundtrack albums or the original cast albums in their homes and put them on their hi-fi. It made sense for corporations to say, all right, now we have a vast population of people who are predisposed to like this kind of entertainment, and now there are long-playing records. You can put a whole show's worth of material on one disc. Let's tap into this really vibrant entertainment form and just shift it to tell our own stories and our own messages. By the 80s, you have people entering the sales force in the working world who maybe didn't care about the old line musicals so much, and they had grown up with the Beatles and Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones. And then you start seeing by the late 70s, early 80s, the industrial shows are trying to chase after that, and you get disco-themed shows, and you get ones with a much more of a rock feel. And the center doesn't hold for a while on the world of Broadway. And yet here we are, the wheel has turned, and what's the hottest thing in the world? Hamilton. What else is going on? You can name 10 shows right now on Broadway that you can't get tickets for. Teenagers have them on their playlists, and they're all over Spotify and iTunes. My own daughter's crazy for the Hamilton songs. There's been a turning back to this with a new generation. Whether that means that the corporations will find their way back to it wholeheartedly, I don't know.
You use the term a few times, but especially toward the end of the documentary, eccentric adventures. Certainly there's an eccentricity to this, but for you, the adventure continues.
Yes, I guess I realized at some point, and we all have to realize this some way, we're just interested in what we're interested in. We may never be able to explain it fully to the rest of the world. I've been extraordinarily lucky that a genius filmmaker has explained my eccentric interest so powerfully and elegantly that now millions of people are seeing what I see. But you can't wait for that. The whole end of the movie with the finale song about just don't wait for the world to give the stamp of approval to your particular interest. Just go down a path, and if you're curious, just see where it goes. Not everything is going to turn into the magical adventure I've had, but you just don't want to be 90 years old and thinking, I wish I had pursued that thing I was curious about 50 years ago.
Take that step, shine your light.
That left turn might be right.
Don't wait for the world to say okay. Find your own way.
Find that path others missed. Life is grander with a twist.
There's that knock you've heard before.
Open that door.
At what point in the production of the documentary did it come up that you were going to do a grand finale?
Well, that was a long process to get there. I won't really say too much about the nature of the end of the movie, but there is a musical number that I think leaves people leaving the theater or leaving their living room with a giant smile beaming on their face and their hearts pounding because it is joyous. We talked a lot about what to do at the end of the movie. Deva and her team thought, well, we could restage a lost musical from 50 years ago. There was a lot of back and forth. Ultimately, they decided we have to play the last card in our hand, which is we have said all along during this film that musical theater, whether you're a fan or not, you have to admit that in the right applications done by the right people, it has power. It has a way to reach people with music and drama and comedy and melody. It can do something nothing else can do. I have come to believe that. So we have to prove it and do it ourselves. And that's what we did.
Back to the comedy damage part. There's this really just heartbreaking scene, at least I found it heartbreaking, of you leaving your office at the Letterman show, and you're saying goodbye to the staff, and then you're down at the dumpster looking for some keepsake to put in your bag. And you see the Ed Sullivan Theater just, this is what, a day after?
May 20th was the last show in 2015. 8 a.m. on May 21st, the construction crews arrived to start ripping out the seats and the sets and everything.
I mean, that had to have been gutting.
It was surprising that it was that abrupt and that just blunt. We knew that Stephen Colbert was coming in, and there was a time frame that they had to, like, hurry. But I'll also mention Dave Letterman is in the movie, and I'm one of the few people who's ever been able to sit down and interview him, and he is an executive producer on the film. Yes. We were the only project ever allowed to film backstage and in the offices at the Late Show, so it was a great mark of his belief in the project that he allowed us to do that. But yeah, I'm looking through a dumpster filled with fragments of the set the day after the show ended, and it is wildly bittersweet, especially if you're any sort of Letterman fan. But I also have realized I love that scene of me looking through a dumpster because it's just the cycle beginning again. The whole thing began because I was looking through the dollar bins at record stores, or what have they decided is not worth anything? I want to go in with different eyes and see if I see patterns and material here that I think is worth something if you look at it right. So I've always looked at stuff in dumpsters.
If the show, say, had another 3, 5, 7 years, would you have still found joy in it?
I think I would have. I liked so much working with the other writers and the editors and the producers and just the whole batch of people there. It's a cliche, but it was a family, and it was largely a happy family. And Dave Letterman was an exacting boss and a host who had done it for so long that if you made him laugh, you'd really accomplish something. I mean, we talk about my comedy damage. He's surely got his own version of it. So you felt really good if he saw something that you made and he was tickled and he was happy.
There were those moments where you would see him just with a little turn of phrase, and somebody would say something and he would just repeat it over and over and over again. That seemed to delight him. That seemed to delight you.
He savors not only the large, crazy concepts, but the small grace note details, which I will say, if you love beautiful details, the grand sweep of this documentary is astonishing, but every minute of it has wonderful details and elegant execution. I've watched it, I don't know, 40 times now. Every time I still make notes on something Deva did that astonishes me, and I think people will be finding gems in the details of this for years to come.
The documentary is Bathtubs Over Broadway. It tells Steve Young's story as well as that of the industrial musical. It is an absolute delight. It's available on iTunes. It's available on Amazon, but it's also now streaming on Netflix.
That's right. All your big major home entertainment platforms. You got Google Play and Vudu, and I think it's Redbox, and there may be one or two more. So
it's out there.
It's become very easy to find. We were on the film festival circuit for a year. We had a very vigorous run. Just every film festival, it would be a hit. Deva won a heap of awards for it, and then word spreads, and then 10 more film festivals want it. And then it was in theaters. Limited release, sort of interesting independent theaters for about 6 months, and now it's gone over to the world of home entertainment. And boy, a lot of people are seeing it there. Every day I get emails and messages from people who say, oh my God, I was in that Maiden Form bra show in 1981. It's hilarious. It's never going to end.
Bathtubs Over Broadway, now streaming on Netflix. Steve Young, a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, Joe, it has been a great pleasure for me. It's so much fun to talk with somebody who saw all the levels of this. It's hilarious, it's surreal, but then it gets into the deepest, most universal human questions. That's why people love this movie so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Steve. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
See you.